Dive into purity with North Elevated Water, nature's gift, Elevated. Sourced from pristine BC glaciers, every drop is a sip of freshness. Elevate your hydration. Elevate your day. North Elevated Water, pure, crisp, unparalleled. Available at drinknorthwater.com.
Welcome to Northern Latitudes. I'm Bill Ault. Today's guest is Marcy Marr, currently the Kootenai Conservation Project's Kootenai Connect Manager. Marcy is a conservation ecologist with a lifelong passion to preserving and understanding the natural world. Her work spans several critical projects, but the one that stands out is her involvement with the KCP. This innovative initiative is making waves in the realm of environmental conservation by fostering connectivity and protecting biodiversity in the Kootenai region.
Hello, I'm Marcy Marr, and I'm an ecologist, and I live in the Slocan Valley in the interior British Columbia, and I've spent the last three decades working in mountain ecosystems throughout Western North America.
And the project you're working right now is the Kootenai Connect Project. Can you tell me what it is?
Sure. So Kootenai Connect, it's on the shoulders of a lot of foundational work that's been done on ecological corridors over the last couple decades. It's a building science. And so when thinking about corridors, it's good to think about them in terms of a network. And so Kootenai Connect is a regional network of 12 corridors that in my corner of southeastern BC, it links up important habitats across valleys and mountain systems in order to protect biodiversity. And also large, wide-ranging carnivores like grizzly bears and wolverines and American badgers, and also looks at ungulates like Rocky Mountain elk and bighorn sheep and mountain goats in relation to what they need for their habitat. And given that we're in a changing climate, what that might mean for climate change, where potential climate refugia. So Kootenai Connect is really bringing a lot of lenses to looking at our landscape and ensuring that there's connectivity now for wildlife movement, but also for the larger ecological functions and movement over time.
How did it all start?
Well, I would say there really wasn't a project. There's been a couple streams of information that have come together. I would say my sort of cohort and co-leader in this is Michael Proctor. And Michael comes at it from a couple of decades of grizzly bear habitat research in what he's done in looking at corridors and connectivity. And I have been working on large-scale ecosystem-based projects throughout my career, as well as a very well-known connectivity project called Yellowstone to Yukon. Worked in the late 90s, early 2000s there, putting down the science framework for looking at corridors and connectivity between protected areas. And so, and I've done a lot of wetland ecology and inventories and mapping and assessment. My master's thesis was in riparian habitat. So what Michael and I have known each other through the years, and this idea was something that came up, you know, in conversation, probably over a beer with a napkin and probably some pens, and trying to figure out how to bring together the ideas of what he was seeing on the landscape in terms of the overlap of grizzly bear corridors and connectivity coming through some major wetland riparian complexes in our valley system. Our area is very mountainous. We have four different mountain ranges, and it's sort of like from the Rockies in the east with our border with Alberta, it's like corduroy. You move down through a valley, then up through the Purcells and down through another valley and, you know, up through, you know, the Selkirk. So we have a lot of sort of valley bottom habitat that not only is a central point for wetlands and big complexes of wetlands and riparian areas and rivers, but also human settlement. So, you know, we started looking at a lot of his research and data and this sort of association between grizzly bear corridors moving east-west and north-south along these big riparian complexes and seeing that that overlapping area also included a lot of other biodiversity, whether it was birds or amphibians, looking at just some of the rare plant communities that are out there, and started to move Michael a little bit beyond bears to biodiversity. And with that, sort of this initiative was born to sort of look at our region through that lens of how do we protect the connectivity that already exists within our region, as well as maybe restore and enhance areas where we can.
Now define corridor and what you mean by corridor for me, because
our linkage actually is within is a corner of southeastern BC. So yeah, we are part of Yellowstone to Yukon in terms of the big bioregional, you know, corridor that we used to use the moniker of, you know, 2,000 kilometer long wildlife corridor, because it's spectacular mountain ecosystem. And our area is very important because it is the transboundary with the US, with Alberta, with Montana, Idaho. And so there's a lot happening in our little corner of the world, which, you know, moves from grasslands in the east to the inland temperate rainforest, big cedar trees in the west. And so I guess the simplest definition for corridors is to think about flow of genes, flow of species. Really, it's allowing movement. It's unobstructed movement. And so when we think about corridors, it's not really in a linear form of like hallways and these, like, you know, sometimes it will look a bit blobby and amorphous because of just the way that species are using landscapes. And so it's really about providing the opportunity for, whether it's, you know, toads or bears or elk, to be able to move where they need to move during the time of year they need to, whether it's essential breeding habitat for toads or whether it's grizzly bear huckleberry patches up in the subalpine. You know, these critters need to be able to get to, you know, different kinds of habitat at different times during the year. And more with our changing climate and sort of our disturbance regimes getting pretty intense, whether it's huge floods or whether it's, you know, catastrophic fires, we've got to provide areas for animals to be able to move and adjust. And that's really what connectivity and corridors is about too. It's the flow, but it's also allowing critters to have options within the different sort of seasonal movements and disturbance cycles that are out there in the landscape.
And your project, that's fine. The project itself, the area you cover is massive. I'm pretty familiar with the area, and you named two mountain chains, and I'm thinking there's at least two more that probably within your area. But what kind of an area are we talking about here? Like, what's the
whole entire size of the Kootenays? I'm not exactly sure, but our project area is 17,000 square kilometers. Yeah. So it's basically, if you can think about the height of the Rockies moving westward, and to fill in the gaps for your mountain ranges. So you move into the Purcells, then you cross, you know, Kootenay Lake and that whole beautiful valley there, and you get up into the Selkirks, mm-hmm. and then into the Slocan Valley where I live, and then you're up into the Monashies and Valhallas, and then you're over into the Okanagan. So it's really, you know, we're sort of in this little corner of BC that is bracketed between the Rockies and the Okanagan.
How much change have you seen in the time you've been there?
Yeah. So I guess just the thing that jumps out to all of us here is that we're really dependent on snowpack. So snowpack has been really variable, especially this winter, loss of glaciers. And so there, you know, in looking at the sort of just the hydrologic changes, that's been really, I think, the most noticeable for all of us and what we're able to see. You know, occasionally you'll hear about some, you know, random species that all of a sudden are up here, and it's like, whoa, what are they doing here? And so, you know, we may see where there are critters that start to have range extensions, where some of our species at risk, especially in the grasslands, are because they're at the northern limit of their range. If you go down to Montana, you'd find them more abundant. So we might start to see where we've got more Lewis's woodpecker, more badgers, more Williamson sapsuckers. We may see that we start to find more of these species that we've been monitoring as, you know, sort of species at risk that we're concerned about here. Yeah, so those would be some of them.
You've named quite a few there. Are there some other significant species at risk in that area that people will know of or recognize?
Yeah, so what Kootenai Connect focuses on is 34 different species at risk. And we also have another 40, which we're, you know, monitoring and doing habitat assessments on as a partnership that are of cultural and local interest. So, you know, there's lots of critters we're trying to watch out for. But the ones in particular, I would say that, you know, audiences across Canada, the grizzly bear for sure is on the Federal Species at Risk Act. And there's, you know, others that we have, yeah, been tracking that are maybe more provincially important, like great blue heron. There's various species of bats. And I know Corey Lawson was on one of your programs. And so she has been working as part of Kootenai Connect through the Wildlife Conservation Society. So there's, I think, over 13 bat species that she's monitoring. And there are, you know, bank swallows and barn swallows. And, you know, those are a few. Oh, I should also mention leopard frogs, because one of the remaining breeding populations is in Creston, BC, and that's a part of a Kootenai Connect corridor that we're working on. So runs the gamut that way, trying to include as many different types of biodiversity in this project as we can.
Now, your background, you are from the other side of North America originally, at least school-wise anyways. Going back with you personally, what got you in love? Because you obviously love nature, but what was the trigger for you as a person for that love?
I think for me, I think for a lot of people, it was particular organisms. And I love lots of different animals. But what I was really drawn to, I found over time, were landscapes. I loved mountains. I loved getting into mountains. I loved the discovery, sort of the journey and exploration. And I think, you know, where I started to move from just being a kid who loved nature and was in the backyard and looking for turtles and goofing around in swamps to actually thinking, whoa, maybe I could actually do something with this, was when I was at Middlebury College and I ended up going a couple of semesters. There was a program through the Center for Northern Studies, which is in Northern Vermont. And they basically was a bunch of different kinds of scientists, field botanists and biologists and foresters and anthropologists that would take us out in the field for like months on end. And one of the places that tied me in more with Canada, so I'm based in Vermont, in Northern Vermont, but we went to Newfoundland and Labrador and spent a month and around Gros Morne and the Tablelands and over in Red Bay, Labrador, jigging for cod, you know, before I really knew there'd be a collapse, and, you know, doing really learning about the Arctic alpine tundra plants and just the littleness of some of the amazing things in nature. And so I think that got me started in really seeing, you know, what was possible. But I think my interest in sort of getting at connectivity and being concerned about, you know, how landscapes function was when I was working for the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And one of our big projects that we were working on was called Parker's Gore. And it was in the Appalachian area in the Green Mountains. And there was a beautiful, lush, big, you know, undeveloped area that Killington Ski Resort wanted to develop for extra, you know, great ski runs and all of that. And it also was fabulous for black bears, and it had massive mature beech trees, and beech nuts are like a dive of chocolate for bears in the fall for hibernation. So after many years of sort of working on that project and with different bear experts and sort of figuring out with the state and state biologists what it meant to actually be looking at corridors, where are they, how wide, what do we mean by them, the state then got very involved and declared that area sensitive habitat, ended up doing a land swap and a few things. There were some big meetings with, you know, the parks, National Park Service, as well as all the parties trying to figure out a solution. And the solution became that this area needed to be conserved. And there was some land swapping that went on to give Killington some other terrain. And I that really opened up my eyes to what was possible in terms of looking at wildlife corridors and connectivity.
In the corridor aspect of things, it's become an international quest as well.
Absolutely. And through the IUCN and some of the new global biodiversity frameworks that have been coming out through various COPs, in particular the last one, COP15, recognizing connectivity as being essential for conserving biodiversity, essential for climate resilience in our landscapes. So I would say connectivity now is something that has been recognized globally. And because connectivity can happen at multiple landscape scales, so you can be looking at it globally, or like in the case of Yellowstone to Yukon, continentally, or you can zoom down into our scale of the Kootenays. And that's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of projects and work that can help conserve and improve habitats. And it then can sort of, you know, meet up with some of these larger scale conservation initiatives. And so I think that, you know, we're at a really interesting time in conservation history to be able to bring in connectivity with such recognition of its importance.
We'll be right back.
This spring, embark on an adventure like no other. Join us at the Northern Latitudes Film Festivals, showcasing the spirit of exploration and the thrill of the great outdoors. First up, the world tour stop of the Paddling Film Festival on April 17th. Feel the rush of water and the pulse of the paddle. Then, elevate your spirit with the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival on May 15th. Experience the highs of adventure right at the heart of downtown Brockville at the Aquatarium. Shows start at 7 p.m. both nights. Tickets are available now at northernlatitudes.ca.
Seven Summit Snacks. Fuel your next adventure with chocolate crafted to conquer. Made with ethically sourced chocolates and ingredients you know and understand. Find your next taste adventure at 7summitsnacks.com.
We are losing a great deal of biodiversity. What do you think it means to us as humans if we start losing this biodiversity?
So I'm sort of struggling with that answer because I can go two ways. One is personal, and the other is I just think there's everything has a function or a place in the ecology, in the community, right? So from a personal level, I think sometimes it takes really interacting with some of these species to get to know them. And then you realize, oh my gosh, there's intrinsic value to so many things. And whether it's really understanding how a moss community works and all of the different ways that the structuring and layering of different species of moss can support different invertebrates and how they respond to moisture and can dry out for years and then reemerge, or looking at toads and the amount of landscape that they sort of need to move around. They hibernate like bears, but they come right back to their, you know, where they were born. And that's where they breed. And so there's this fidelity, there's some compasses, some internal like compass within some of these species that absolutely marvels me, that they know where to go, what to do. It's sort of looking at, you know, flocks of birds and wondering, how do they know? How do they know to go all the way, you know, to Chile? So I think there's that wonder part of it for me, the fact that every time I hear of new species being discovered or something interesting about them that we hadn't known or thought about, I just think the natural world's so phenomenal in terms of providing us with access to understanding life and understanding how life sort of works beyond our sort of day-to-day human construct of it. Yeah, so that's a combination, I guess, of personal and ecological.
Well, you're right. It is so marvelous. Like, I mean, the one that always amazes me in my area and at home is because I've lived basically in the same spot of ground for most of my years. And it's the snapping turtles that always come back to lay their eggs in the same places. And you watch it year after year and you just
how, why, like it, and then, but it's still marvelous that they do it. And it's just incredible.
So to tie this back to Kootenai Connect, because we have Western painted turtles out here. So when you find an area like that, that is just absolutely prime for turtle nesting, and the turtles are returning and using that area, what we have been doing in some of our work is enhancing the nesting habitat by providing more gravels. We've also been looking at how many, you know, in some cases, it's the transportation corridors because of the gravels that they bring in and the maintenance that keeps the vegetation down. Turtles end up, you know, associating with road cuts sometimes. So there's been underpasses and various structures created so they're not being so, you know, they were not being killed on the highways. And also just thinking about predation, as you mentioned, the raccoons. For us, it could be skunks or, you know, just about anything that can get into these nests. So I think that's when this starts to get on the ground and it starts to become real for folks to understand how these corridors work, is when they see turtles moving between two areas and realizing that maybe something's in jeopardy, like being able to make it to those nesting areas if they have to cross a road from the wetland where they spend most of their time. So, you know, that's at a smaller scale, but those are some of the projects where partners of ours are working on as well.
Two things there. What's another project with smaller animals? Because we always talk about the big guys, but what's another project you're doing to help the smaller ones?
So the toads, they're dear to my heart because I have a research project on Western toads just up from my house. And so the importance of toads is that they, unlike turtles, which are mostly aquatic and go to, you know, the terrestrial environment to go to these particular gravels to lay their eggs, and then it's usually the females moving back and forth. For toads, they're mostly terrestrial. So they move to breed in aquatic, you know, wetlands and ponds. And so they move there to these aquatic habitats to breed. And then they go back and forage and hibernate and, you know, are mostly terrestrial. So it's interesting to be looking at both of those critters within our work. And toads are amazing because they can travel, you know, 7-8, you know, whatever kilometers up into the subalpine. And so sometimes you might be going for a hike in the mountains around here, and all of a sudden you'll see this big female toad just nestled into the moss in a little trickle, you know, coming off of an outcrop. So they always fascinate me because they're able to cover such big distances. They really link the terrestrial and aquatic environments. And again, in our mountainous region, there's sometimes highways that are separating their terrestrial from their aquatic habitats. So one of the projects I'm working on, we just had two underpasses installed by the Ministry of Transportation. Yay. And now we're keeping toads off the road. And we had been out for the last 9 summers as researchers, and also through a volunteer program, our toad ambassadors of local volunteers out night with headlamps and moving toads off the road. You know, sometimes, you know, 600-700 toads, you know, over the course of a season. And it's a fascinating way to learn more about a species, bring in volunteers. And the cool thing about some of these sites, like this particular one, is at a rest stop. And so all the kids can go in and they can see the eggs, the tadpoles. They then can see the little baby toadlets, you know, sort of warming up and staging, getting ready for their big migration. And so the toads have an interesting story. And this is all, you know, within a huge corridor for grizzly bears and wolverine, and they get up into places with the mountain goats. And so we try to, you know, look at it all as multi-species as possible. But as you said, these little guys, they also help bring us down to that microcosm of just how important particular areas and small spaces are for these critters.
And you've got a huge number of partners in this project. How hard is it to keep everybody? I mean, everybody obviously wants to advance their own cause. And what's the challenges in keeping that many partners kind of working together? Is it harder than it sounds, easier than it sounds, or is it just because everybody's got the same kind of general focus on what they want done. What does the partnership bring to them?
Yeah. So in terms of partners, a couple things. So one of the organizations I work with is the Kootenai Conservation Program. And I've been working with them for over 15 years in various capacities. And they're a fabulous partnership of over 85 land and water, you know, conservation stewardship groups, agricultural producers, land trusts, First Nations, educational institutions. So it ends up being a big tent. And so when Kootenai Connect started to become something that Michael and I and others wanted to pursue, it was really, we hadn't even had the ink dry on this big sort of proposal that we had put out as a preliminary assessment. And the Federal Environment and Climate Change Canada had a grant intake for looking at community nominated priority places for protecting species at risk. And so within working with KCP, there emerged, you know, probably 12 or so different partners that we said, hey, we could all be working on this together, because Michael and I had about 12 different corridors we wanted to assess, you know, over time. But four of them we thought were corridors with champions that we thought we should get started on. And voila, we then had this, you know, opportunity to pull together 12 different partners in four areas and begin to see how various projects could come together. And I've been really amazed. It's an A team of people. I mean, it's fabulous organizations and people, and it has not been herding cats, which I know a lot of people worry about when they're doing partnership work. But this collaboration has been so synergistic and powerful. I just have to commend all these organizations, ranging from like the Nature Conservancy of Canada, the Wildlife Conservation Society, Columbia Wetland Stewardship Partners. We really run the gamut of lots of different kinds of organizations, as well as many independent biologists that are all sort of weighing in. And over the years, we're up to now close to 40 different partners and specialists that are working on Kootenai Connect. And we've expanded from four corridors to now seven. And so that's about 50 different projects, and our funding's been extended for a few years. So, you know, we've got probably about $8 million worth of projects that we'll have completed by 2026. And we're in the reporting phase now, because it's March Madness and reporting. But honestly, Bill, it's been a pleasure. It's a really great group, and the amount of habitat improvements that have been done looking across all of this just really makes me support partnerships, because these organizations could have continued doing some things separately, and they would have. But when you start to work and roll up the different results, sometimes in the same landscape, sometimes across landscapes, you really start to see the power of the conservation that we can do together.
It sets a great example for people that are doing not just this kind of project, but all kinds of projects, when they know that, you know, it can be done when people decide that something important needs to be done. What's up next for Kootenai Connect?
I don't think right now. No, I would say we're not necessarily doing new projects, but we are continuing and I would say expanding some of the wetland work and hydrologic assessments that have been done. There's more of an attention now, not only to thinning in grasslands, but also thinking about it from a fire perspective. So there's those sorts of expanding ideas. And in terms of what Michael and I are doing, but more in a conservation planning context, is we've selected one of the corridors, which is Columbia Lake, which is in the East Kootenai. And Columbia Lake is also the headwaters of the Columbia River, and very, very important to the Tanaha people and Shuswap and local people there, as well as Parks Canada and the provincial government, and there's provincial parks. And so we've looked at that area, you know, as an east-west north part of a north-south corridor. It's very important, but we've decided to look at that also as a pilot one to create an ecological corridors conservation plan. And so what we're doing now is we've assessed the conservation values of this landscape. We're looking at what are some of the best management practices for that corridor, because corridors are not about, you know, creating parks. They're about looking at the existing land use pattern and land ownership pattern. So it includes private land. It'll be multi-jurisdictional. And what really will be the sort of the guiding premise within being in a corridor is providing safe passage for wildlife. So there's that connectivity part of it is twofold. One is connectivity for the wildlife and to, you know, look at how wetlands and water is able to move. But the other is connecting people as neighbors. They're working out coexistence strategies. We're figuring out maybe some wildlife friendly fencing or, you know, looking at better bear smart practices for how humans keep garbage and barbecues and that sort of thing. But also thinking about how across borders we may be managing for thinning and grassland protection. Thinning trees, grassland protection, and thinking about living more in habitat and in ecosystems together than just on small little parcels of land that, you know, just happen to share a border with somebody.
Thanks, Marcy.
Okay, thank you so much, Bill. I really appreciate being on your show.
That's it for this episode. Thanks to Marcy Marr for sharing her insights and experiences with the Kootenai Connects project. Thanks as well to our listeners and the sponsors, Seven Summit Snacks and North, who helped make all this possible. For more information about Marcy Marr and the Kootenai Connects program, be sure to check out the links in the show notes. We encourage you to get involved, whether it's through supporting local conservation efforts, educating others about the importance of biodiversity, or simply spending more time in nature to appreciate the world around us. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite platform to stay updated on future episodes. For even more content, including all our podcasts, my photography, and the Northern Latitude events, go to northernlatitudes.ca. Theme music and sound logo produced by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise in Kingston. Closing music is called Coming Storm by Four Trees. To leave a comment or suggestion, email me at podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. Until next time, I'm Bill Ault. Find your way to Northern Latitudes. Thank you.